Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Robert O'Hearn. And we're across from Lee Sales. I've had a little tiny bit of an anxiety attack about us interviewing the best interviewer in Australia. But I'm calmed down because the book you come to talk about, Any Ordinary Day, is so good. Both Rob and I are quite cool about this. We're quite relaxed.
I'm relaxed now too. So it's not going to be a 7:30 style grilling.
No, we can't. We never thought we would. to be honest, there's no chance in hell. But when we do sit across from someone who does this for a living, it sort of does make us a little bit more conscious of how we approach it.
Well, do you know, for me, sitting at this end of it is really nerve-wracking, because when you're the person asking questions, you're driving it, you're in control of it.
Yep.
When you're the person at the other end, I reckon it's heaps more nerve-wracking. I would much rather be talking to you guys than you guys talking to me.
and you see, we have no questions in front of us.
You have no foreknowledge
of what we're going to ask.
You probably don't have any foreknowledge of it yourself.
No, we're just going to go with you. We're going to go with the flow.
See, that's the key to a good interview, though, going with the flow. So I'm in safe hands, apparently.
Oh, great. Wonderful. reading this, I mean, there are a lot of different stories within your full story. But the full story is around what people do after the worst day of their life. Can you set it up a little bit just for the listeners to get an idea of why you did this and why you approached it?
Yeah, I think for my day job hosting 7:30, every day there will be someone on my show that has just been blindsided by something that comes out of absolutely nowhere, and you know they are living the worst day of their life. And the nature of news and current affairs is that you're just presented with those sort of scenarios over and over again. And because I'm immersed in that every night, it probably has created a bit of anxiety for me, where I think, oh, geez, you know, that could be me, or why wouldn't that be me? So I had thought about that a lot. And then in 2014, I had a really bad year myself, and I had, with the birth of my first child, it was nearly fatal for both of us. And so that really threw me as well, and it was followed up by a series of difficult life events as well. And so I felt like, oh, I have now become the person that, you know, this, my good luck's all run out, and it's just a series of challenges. And so I started looking at the question of, well, what comes next, partly as a, I guess, a way for me to try to make sense of what was going on in my own life, and also what I was seeing on my own show every night, because I felt like, wow, is it this bad? You know, is life this bad? And do things, once something really terrible has happened to you, do things, you know, improve? And what happens next? Because then on the news, it's presented as, you know, you present this frozen moment of tragedy, and then the next night is just another frozen moment of tragedy. Mm. So I wanted to go beyond that.
Is this kind of a bit of therapy for you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was. And I was scared when I started it, because often, you know, sometimes when I'm doing 7:30, if there's a story that I feel like, oh, that's going to be particularly sad, I'll say to them, can you turn down the volume to the studio floor? Because I fear that I might cry, or I might be able to not hold it together for the next item. And so I've often been scared to look at those sorts of things head on. And so when I started doing this book, I thought, gee, you know, a bit worried that this might drive me into like total depression or something. But actually it was the complete opposite. I felt like I'm just amazed at what people are able to, what human beings can adapt to. And I did a lot of, as well as talking to people about their experiences, I looked a lot at psychological research about how the brain processes shock and trauma and blindsides and chance and coincidence and all these kind of things. And that also helped me a lot understand just how I react to things. So, for example, recently my father died, and while understanding how my brain would deal with that because it happened suddenly, I knew what I was doing. It didn't stop me from doing it. It didn't stop me from having certain emotions or reacting in certain ways, but I understood that that is how your brain works. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, for me, that made me feel more at ease with it, because I felt like, yep, this is normal. This is how everyone processes grief, and it's not the rest of my life. Like, it'll pass at a certain point. So that it has helped me a lot.
There's a thing that grief counsellors say about how everybody experiences grief in a totally different way, and there's no right way, no wrong way. I think that's one of the beauties of your book, is not just the grief aspect, but people experience any black swan event in a different way.
Totally. And they reach for different ways of coping too. So some people, for example, particularly when it's a public event, like say Rosie Batty losing her son, some people will then become activists for a certain cause because they try to, they don't want it to happen to somebody else and they don't want their loved one's death to be in vain. Other people, it alters their perspective on life. And so they decide, oh, you know what, I want to change my job or I want to move countries or I need to live more in the moment. And so people have this range of different ways that they cope. And I found that really interesting too, that there's not one way to get through things. There's lots of different ways people can get through.
I was reading it going, okay, well, I'm a novelist. I'll react in a particular way that's different. Then you actually talk to a novelist about the reaction to the death of the husband. And again, I thought because novelists like to delve into all the different corners of the psyche and personal experience, and we're meant to know stuff. It was kind of, because I was kind of reading it, trying to pretend that no, this wouldn't happen to me, or this I wouldn't work in that way, and it helped me unravel a little bit that experience. And it seems idiotic for me to have got that far.
No, but I think you do have a certain exceptionalism where I don't know that we do it consciously. I think maybe it's subconscious, where there's certain things where you find it easier. Like say for example, Stuart Diver, who lost his wife in 1997 in the Thredbo landslide. I don't find Stuart's story particularly difficult because I think somewhere in my subconscious I'm going, well, that wouldn't happen to me because I don't go skiing. Yeah. I wouldn't be in a I don't do much outdoorsy stuff. I'd never be somewhere where there'd be a landslide. And so I just discount it. Of everyone's story in the book, the one that I found the hardest and, in fact, the only person that I cried in front of while interviewing them was Michael Spence, who's the Vice Chancellor of Sydney University, whose wife died in her 40s suddenly of cancer. They had five children. She was diagnosed and 3 weeks later died. It was that aggressive. And there was something about that story that I felt like it felt threatening to me because it felt like, well, that could happen to me. Mm. And also the fact that they had young children and stuff and I have young children. So I think the closer the parallels to your own life, the more confronting the person's experience is. That's why I think when, say, a news story happens like the Lindt Cafe, it really rattles everybody, even if you were nowhere near it, because you feel, or if you didn't know anyone there, because you feel like that could have happened to me, because you probably go to a cafe reasonably regularly and have a coffee, and so it seems very familiar, and everyone there was just going about their everyday life, and then their everyday life was turned upside down, and so that feels threatening to us. Whereas, again, another story that I didn't find personally difficult was James Scott, who was a medical student. It was a massive news story in the 1990s. He went trekking in Nepal and he got lost and he was lost for 42 days. And then he was miraculously found alive. It's considered one of the great survival tales, of the modern era. Again, because I think, well, I wouldn't be trekking in Nepal, I wouldn't get lost. Da, da, da. So you sort of, you think, oh, that's not that confronting to me. So it's really interesting how your brain subconsciously connects with certain ones and not with others.
You talked about being on TV and not looking at some of the more distressing articles because you didn't want to be. But in this book, you're actually opening up to an audience, us, the reader, quite a lot, and exposing that you are vulnerable to these horrible circumstances. Was that a conscious decision? Was that difficult to actually allow people into that side of your life?
That was hard, but when I decided I wanted to look at this issue, when I started doing it, I didn't necessarily think it would be a book. I just thought, I'm going to just start on this exploration and see where it leads. And it may not be, I may not be able to make a total book out of this, but it might just help me myself. And then over time, as I realized, yep, there is a book here, I had a lot of content that was sort of disparate because everyone's, I'd interviewed a number of people who terrible things had happened to. I'd interviewed a number of people who are the sort of people who are, I guess, frontline responders when terrible things happen, like a priest and someone who works at the morgue and people, the coroner, the state coroner. And then I was also looking at psychological research and scientific research. And so to make it work as a book, and so it wouldn't feel like just a ton of, different things, it needed something to tie it together. And really the only thing structurally that I could see that could make that work as a whole piece of work was to make it a first-person narrative about my exploration of the subject. And I also felt like if I didn't open up about why was I preoccupied with this sort of little bit confronting subject, then it would seem maybe confusing or a bit less authentic. So I felt like, you know what, I feel like I have to be honest that what I see on the news really rattles me, and I've had a pretty shit time in my own life and that's rattled me, and that's why I'm exploring this. And so then I wanted to be able to lead the reader through at the start feeling really rattled and not comfortable and fearful, and then by the end, you know, I still feel rattled and fearful because life is like that, but I feel like I've got some tools and a bit of hope that I'll be able to manage, and that we all, I think, you look at things that happen to other people and think, well, I could never cope if that happened to me. But chances are you probably would. Like, what you can manage and cope with is so far beyond your expectations. That's not to say it's easy, but you probably will cope.
Yeah, it's amazing the toolkits that people find they have. Did you find you had tools that you didn't know you had?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think I've learned that I'm more resilient than I thought. And I think, you know, people think like resilience is some sort of mythical thing that, you know, you can build or whatever. Actually, resilience is just getting out of bed and doing what has to be done every day. And I think when things have not been so good, like I was saying to a friend recently, since my dad died, everything feels a bit harder. Like it feels like all my normal activities, it's like I'm sort of wading through mud or something to be able to do them. So I feel like I'm not operating at my normal capacity. Everything's just hard. But, you know, that's just how things are. And that's okay. Like I sort of am able to you know, just roll with that, basically. What was the question? Sorry. See, this is why I like asking them, not answering them.
No, it wasn't really much of a question. It was about tools that you found.
Oh, yeah, tools that I had, yeah. So just my capacity to keep just getting out of bed every day.
Yeah.
And also just things that you have to do, just things that you would not choose to do but you have to do. Like one of my children around the same time my father died had an operation, and I have to do some daily things with him that I find personally difficult because I'm have a low gross tolerance, I guess, for medical things. And but like it just has to be done. And so I just do it. It doesn't mean I like doing it. I just do it. And so, yeah, you just – so I've sort of learned that. The other thing I think I've really learned is just how much other people help you, like the kindness of other people. And I think that's a repeated theme in the book, that people get blindsided by life and they don't know how they're going to cope, and then friends or strangers sort of step in extraordinary ways, even tiny ways, and it just makes a difference, and it makes you see that life is worth, you know, going on with. Because you know, someone might do something like, there's one person in the book who her partner is murdered, and a priest arrives at the house and he just picks up a vase of dead flowers and moves it to another room. And she says, or puts in the bin. And Juliet, the woman, says, I know it sounds ridiculous, but it just basically gave me some hope that there was life. And she sort of found it hard to explain because it seemed like such a minor thing. But she said, sometimes in these moments, it is the minor things that make you feel like you can carry on.
That's one of the things that I took from it was, although it's a book about horrible circumstances, the community and friendships and family coming in and people you didn't expect. Like there was one part in it where you're talking about people's reaction to it. Some people just can't cope and turn away.
Yeah.
And then the least expected person in your life is the one who actually comes in with the shining armor and solves the problem.
Totally. And you sort of look at people in different ways. Like some of my, you know, before 2014 for me, I would have said, oh, my favorite friends are the ones who have got a lot of charisma and they're funny and they make you laugh a lot and they've got hilarious stories to tell and you know, have awesome dinner parties laughing. And then of recent years, I feel more like I value more the people who maybe aren't such sparkling company, but they're just really kind and thoughtful. I see huge value in those sort of people that have empathy, and the sort of people as well who don't just go, oh, well, let me know if you need anything. The people that just literally show up with something and help really practically. Like my littlest son on his second and third birthdays, my eldest son was in hospital. And on both occasions, friends made birthday cakes for the little child because they knew that I wasn't really able to. And they didn't really say, oh, let me know if you want me to make the birthday cake. They were just like, listen, I'll make a birthday cake. And then it just gets taken care of because you hate as a person asking for help. So if people just step in and do stuff for you, or again, you know, when Dad died, a friend of mine in Brisbane, who's not even a close friend, just, you know, more a friend of a friend, said to me, look, I live by myself. I've got three empty bedrooms. Let me know if you have anyone coming from interstate that you want somewhere, they need somewhere to stay. And I can do airport runs, running them to and from the memorial to the airport to my house, whatever. So I've also learned to just when people offer to help to go yes instead of like, oh, no, it's okay. So, I mean, you know what? That would be great. My friend Andrea is coming up from Sydney. Could you look after her? And Pip went, yep, no problem, and was totally taken care of. And it was just such an incredibly useful thing for somebody to offer to do. And it's just so much more meaningful than someone giving you a hug and going, oh, I hope you're okay. Like, it was actually, you know, helpful to me.
Because you talk about the awkwardness with such things, because it doesn't happen. Like if we were living in 19th century London, we'd all be like, yeah, death, we know all about it.
Totally, because you're not often around it. And it was interesting with some of the people in the book how a couple of themes came through where multiple people mentioned them. One was after you've experienced great loss, it's sometimes compounded by further loss because people that you thought were your friends turn out to be not such good friends because they can't cope with what's happened to you and they sort of shy away from it. The other thing that two people mentioned that had never crossed my mind, they both mentioned how confronting it was to go to the grocery store for the first time after they'd lost somebody because all they could see was all the things that they didn't need to buy anymore.
Yeah, that was very moving. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, I had never thought of it either. And it's funny now when I'm in the grocery shop, I sometimes will think about that and when someone's pushing a trolley the other way and I think you just never know. Like they could be having a terrible day because, you know, it's the first time they've been shopping.
And so the idea of death, now that it's sort of you've been thinking about it, have you changed in the way in which you think about it for yourself? Are you able to think more about it? So are you making plans in your head about life ahead and like that sort of thing?
I'm more accepting of and just conscious that death is part of life. And I mean, I still am scared of it and I don't want to die anytime soon. But for example, when while I was working on this book, one of my good friends had terminal cancer. And I think before I'd started working on this book, I would have been scared to go and visit him and I would have been worried about, oh, I might be intruding or whatever. This time I thought, no, I just have to be there. And a priest in the book talked about the need to accompany people when they're on these sorts of sad journeys, for lack of a better word. And I felt like, well, I accompanied Mark to the pub when we were having good times and I accompanied Mark, you know, here and there. And the least I can do, given our friendship, is accompany him when he's having the hardest thing going on ever in his life. Now, that's not to say that I didn't bumble around and say the right thing and I say the wrong thing and I didn't sometimes know what to do and I could have gone up to hospital more often and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But I feel very assured that I was there at least. I didn't shy away from stepping in. Now as well, you know, if a friend loses somebody, I don't shy away from saying, I'm really sorry that your mother died. Or whatever, I just barrel sort of directly in with it. Because another thing people said to me was how hurtful it was if it wasn't acknowledged, if people just sort of pretended like, oh, God, I just don't want to acknowledge, you know, that even happened. And I think the other thing that really has changed in my thinking about death is I would have previously been really scared to see a dead body or to be with someone when they died. And all of the research, well, there's two things. One is that it is helpful for your brain to process if someone close to you has died to see them dead because they can't, then you know that they're not just on holidays or you just haven't seen them or whatever. The other bit of research is that it's best to, people unfortunately have to make some really difficult decisions when they're very vulnerable around times of death and suffering. And one of those things is, say, if you're not with someone when they die, do you see their body at the morgue or at the funeral parlour? As well as the research showing that it is helpful to do that, it also shows that what is deeply unhelpful is if you are forced to make a decision that's contrary to what you want to do. So if you feel like, I don't really want to see mum, and your brother or your sister talks you into it, that can correlate with not very good coping later. Or if you wanted to see the body and someone says, oh, you don't really want to, you know, it's a bit, it's, you know, rough, and you get talked out of it, that can also be damaging. I would have said prior to this book that I was the sort of person that didn't want to see someone's dead body. And then now, so when my friend Mark died, I was at the hospital that morning. I did go in to see him. When my father died, I was with him when he died. And I think that I'm glad that I did that, even though it was awful and sad. I still am glad that I did that. So that has changed in my thinking as well.
One of the things I found really interesting about this book was the idea of chance. Why them? Why me? Why over there? What are the odds?
Yeah, and that to me, you know, is a fascinating thing, because the human brain, you know, unusual events like, say, the Lint Cafe, our brain puts things like that in neon lights because it finds them really confronting. And so you feel like, oh, wow, that could have been me. When you actually crunch the numbers down, you know, your chance of being in the Lint Cafe, I think the population of Australia at the time was 24 million. Your chance of being in the Lint Cafe on the cold hard numbers is 18 in 24 million. You could perhaps whittle that down further. Like, let's say if you worked in the Sydney CBD, maybe it was 18 in 4 million. So you could sort of, you know, crunch that around. But the reality is that the planet is the ultimate large sample size, which means that the odds of something weird happening to any one of us is very, very slim. The thing that's less comforting is that even if the odds are one in a billion, somebody's the one, and there's no way to guarantee that that's not you. Yeah. So even if I said to you, today in Australia, there's going to be one thing's going to happen that's a one in a million chance, you'd think, well, that's pretty remote. Well, Australia has a population of 25 million, so that means 25 Australians will be the person that a one in a million thing happens to. And 25 seems suddenly like, wow, 25 people are going to get a one in a million thing happen to them today. So I found all of that research completely fascinating as well. Things like coincidence, how often we try to ascribe meaning to things that are just straight coincidence. Like, say, again, to use the Lint Cafe example, you always see this after major events like that. There'll be stories in the paper for people saying, wow, I was meant to be there, but I missed my bus. Or I was there the day before and I changed the date, you know, blah, blah, blah. You always see these sorts of stories and people think it signifies something that, you know, I was meant to not be there. But then, you know, you got to flip that around. So what, the 18 people that were there, they were meant to be there? Were they like they deserved to be there for some reason? The two of the 18 that were there, you know, two were killed. What, they deserved to be killed and the other 16 didn't deserve it? Like, once you start thinking in that sort of a way, it's really sort of fraught. And in fact, one of the people in the book who I deliberately wanted her in it because she had multiple sclerosis and was a hostage in the Lint Cafe. And I felt like, geez, that is, you know, were you sitting in there as the hostage thinking, are you effing kidding me? I've got MS and now I'm going to be a hostage in a terrorist drama? And I calculated, I got the Bureau of Statistics to help me calculate the odds of ticking both those boxes. It's one in 1.39 billion. And, you know, it's that sort of thing. You think, well, what, so Louisa Hope, for some reason, what, deserves to have those things? No, it's just random. It was just straight, just bad luck that she's got, you know, both of those things. Or you might believe in God, you might choose to believe, you know, God did that. But Louisa Hope herself, who's a Christian, said to me, she described it as a rat bag delusion, that it's a rat bag delusion to think that you've been singled out or saved or protected for some reason and somebody else has not.
Lee, thank you so much for coming in and talking about Any Ordinary Day. We both absolutely love it, so we're going to be telling everyone we know to read it. And I think it has such great benefits for us right now. As we mentioned earlier, we don't really have much experience with this sort of thing.
Well, I hope so. So thank you very much.
As I was reading it, I thought this is useful not just to everybody, but to people who work in counselling, people who work in media, people who work in a whole range of different things.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope it does, and I hope it helps people, as particularly who perhaps have been blindsided by something in their lives and, you know, feel like, oh, God, this is, you know, there's no hope, because there is.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thanks.
And you can get hold of Any Ordinary Day at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.